To appease everyone is to please no one. We must understand this because tribalism is profitable. Nuance is a no man's land because there's no one to rally around you.
You're listening to The Brendan Murata Show.
In this episode, I talked to Joshua Lysak, the author of So Good They Call You Fake, and the upcoming book Unhumans, The Secret History of Communist Revolutions and How to Crush Them. Joshua is the ghostwriter of nearly 100 books. He has some excellent advice in this episode on writing, marketing, and persuasion. And I gotta say, there is so much in this episode that I might have to invite Joshua back for a part two when his next book is out. So if you like this episode, let me know. Please share it everywhere on social media. And without further ado, here's Joshua. Before we get started, by the way, I want to know, Unhumans, what's the thesis of that book?
Yeah, the hypothesis of the new book with Jack Posobiec is that a communist revolution, whether it's called a communist or a cultural revolution or a color revolution or cultural Marxism or progressivism, leftism, socialism, whatever you want to call it, the book traces the last 250 years worth of revolutions to identify a specific process they follow, the procedure of radical revolutionary change that often involves political disruptions, institutional takeover, and even outright warfare. And what we find out is that the modern malaise of the West that everyone feels to an extent but can't quite explain what's going on exactly, what we see these sort of culture war skirmishes that result in someone being taken out, right? Debanked, deplatformed, and so on. What we're witnessing in the Western world, we hypothesize, is an irregular communist revolution. Warfare has changed. So too has political uptake, upheaval, uprising. Warfare used to be armies with bullets at each other. But warfare has transitioned in many ways to being what's called gray zone warfare, where powers are fighting one another via supply chain disruptions, cyber attacks, proxy battles, these sorts of things, rather than having open conflict. And yet the conflict is still very real, but it's called gray zone warfare or low intensity conflict. And we hypothesize that political revolution, particularly communism, has also followed that transition of warfare. And so what we propose is that the best way to describe, predict, and prescribe what to do about it in the Western world is that we are currently experiencing a gray zone communist revolution, a low intensity revolutionary war that's every bit as real as a communist revolution has been in the past, but it's much sneakier and therefore has not been met with resistance over the last 60 years of seizure, a long march through all institutions. And it's very much following the ancient Chinese military tactic of winning without fighting.
That sounds super interesting. I wish you'd give me a review copy ahead of time because I would read that.
We're not done with it yet, actually. We're still working on the manuscript. Hence why no review copies available right. Yet.
Well, most of my questions might be about writing process in the first book, which I have here.
Yes, the classic.
Let's start here. How many books have you written at this point?
At this point, it's 91, 92, something like that. I lost count right around 85, and I might be undercounting, but we're past 90, most likely at this point.
Are you going to have a celebration at 100?
That might be at my official retirement from ghostwriting.
So in your book, you talk about having a system of genius for whatever you do. Obviously, if you have written that many books, you have a writing system. What is your writing process?
It starts with what the job being done for the reader is. So this is the foundational process for writing a book. It's what comes before writing the book, in the same way that before you construct a building upwards, you got to build the solid foundation into the earth, right? So the process for building that literary foundation is to use the jobs to be done framework, the JTBD, which is often used for successful software companies and other product launches out of the California-based companies. But it's not been used successfully in the New York publishing scene perhaps one lone exception. This one. Jobs to be done tells that customers buy tools to get jobs done. They decide which tool to use for that particular job based on perception of value, which is going to get the job done the best, the fastest, the cheapest, the easiest, the most superior relative to the alternatives I could try or I have tried. And that's the dynamic into which authors are launching their books. And so in order to produce a successful book, we have to ask, what's it for? 9 times out of 10, an author has no idea what to answer to that question. When I'll ask them, what's your book about? And they'll say, well, it's about productivity secrets, or it's about my management consulting experience in the Fortune 500, or it's a radical new process for doing something really old everyone's already done. You see, and this is in health, wellness, fitness, current events. It's in every industry where there is a how-to book being published. And I'll ask them, so how do I know your book worked? What did it help me get done? And the answer will be vague, like, well, you know, it'll be like you're way more productive. Is that what your customer wants to accomplish? What does it mean to be more productive? How do they know that it worked? Well, you know, it's a bunch of ideas and in some studies and some science, you know, got some pop psychology in there from Andrew Huberman that I've borrowed. Okay, but what are you teaching me to do? How do I know you're going to get me the result you're promising? And what is the result you're promising? And then usually that by that point, they've checked out and decided to go with a different ghostwriter or a publishing company who will tell them what they want to hear. So I found myself outside of some of the popular circles in this industry simply because I don't believe aspiring authors at their word. I don't take them at the word of their ideas. And yet the result of following Jobs to Be Done theory to lay the literary foundation of your book before you even start writing, it enables you to produce a more commercially viable book, a more useful book that has an outsized impact in your industry. Even if you have no audience when you launch, even if your business itself has just launched and you're not someone who has all the industry credibility and cred, and therefore you were just going to make it anyway big with whatever book you wrote, regardless of what topic it was about. Jobs Be Done Theory is the foundation that makes me unique in the publishing industry as being a proponent of that, where everyone else follows product market fit hypothesis, which is you create a product and then try to find the market for it and help you find a fit. This is why 90% plus of books fail, both in traditional publishing and in new publishing, self-publishing technologies, is the author writes a book that's their ideas, it's their theories, it's their models, it's their stories, and they hope they can find a demographic or psychographic out there that kind of jives with it. And sometimes there's a big hit, but the big hits are rare, kind of like lottery winners. I would describe James Clear's book, Atomic Habits, as a lottery winner because the marketing of that book was a product in search of its market. It was billed as being for everyone. It's for teachers, it's for parents, it's for students, it's for kids, it's for business owners, it's for business employees, it's for fitness, it's for... If it's for everyone, it's for no one. We understand this. But what James did in the year prior to promoting the book is he sent advanced copies to influencers in several different niches because he didn't know which one it was going to be a resonant book with. And he initially found out that it resonated with vegan influencers and with CrossFit people. And now it's kind of the mainstream book that's particularly popular with solopreneurs and aspiring entrepreneurs and in other industries. But most books are not successful with this sort of spray and pray approach to book marketing. It's a product in search of a market. If you ask what it does for you and how do you know it worked, it's going to be a vague answer that tells you that it's an ill-fated book for the most part. But the same with a lottery winner. Someone's going to be bound to get the winning ticket most likely. Just so happened to be James in that case, although there could be something said that he was idea laundering ideas from Scott Adams' book, How to Fail at Almost Everything and Still Win Big. So his ideas were already pre-validated as being successful. So he was effectively seizing Scott's ideas and then rewriting them a little bit so they sounded more like his. And then now when people talk about systems versus goals, for example, goals being for losers and systems being for winners, passion is BS, these sorts of things that were originally popularized by Scott Adams in his book. Now, whenever people mention those ideas, they say, James Clear in his book, Atomic Habits, said that systems beat goals. Oh, it's brilliant. Now, I have ethical qualms about recommending this as a strategy. You very well could grab ideas from timeless books pass them off as your own, maybe give like a little passing credit to the author who originated it, and then run with it. And now, as you market your book, you present the ideas as being original to you. That is a strategy, but not necessarily one that I recommend for ethical reasons, although it'll probably work to increase the odds that you'll be one of the lottery winners. But we're still playing the lottery. I don't recommend playing the lottery in this case.
I want to ask about that because it seems like a lot of the advice that you have is geared towards the commercial success of a book. And there are a lot of authors who say that you should write for yourself. You should be a fan of your work first, and you should make something that you are the first audience of, and then think about the commercial audience, the larger world, and that art made for an audience is somehow demeaned or less authentic or less from the heart. And I'm curious what you think of that approach. I mean, Neil Strauss, who's a very successful author, has said this. Also, Rick Rubin in his book, The Creative Act. So what would your response to that be?
Yes. So the advice is contextual. So it's neither right nor wrong. And I'm not disagreeing with it or agreeing it. I'm simply going to contextualize it. Here we go. When Rick or Neil say things like they write from the heart, they create from the heart, they do so from a place of knowing that their material will be consumed by the public. It's Rick Rubin. People are going to buy Rick Rubin because it's Rick Rubin. People are going to buy Neil because it's Neil. The advice to write what you want to read, you're the audience of one, the first audience. I do hear this advice from others, and the advice givers are people whose material is going to be read and shared simply because they already have an audience who's listening to them. And so once you are at that level, you already have an unconscious rapport with your audience. You know what they like to read. You know what topics you're going to be writing about. And therefore, what you come up with for your audience of one is going to be contextualized in the space of things that you care about, that your audience that you have a symbiotic relationship with also cares about most likely. Now, the last 30 seconds or so as a soundbite is not as sexy as write for an audience of one. That advice goes much further than this nuance and recontextualization. If you're a beginner, and the vast majority of people in any industry or space are beginners simply because that's how reality works, if they are to take that advice out of context and say, I should be like Rick Rubin and write for an audience of one, then you'll be like that person who self-publishes 14 novels and has sold a combined total of fewer than 14 copies of all of them. And then you'll be wondering, well, why hasn't it caught on yet? I was doing what Rick Rubin does. Rick Rubin's famous, so I should be too. Failing to realize that that advice comes from that context. In the same way that when Jeff Bezos or Elon Musk attributes the secret of their success to being passion, understand that passion is the result of being on fire for something that's already working. It's just like an accelerant to what already has ignited, what already has the potential for it, versus I'm super passionate at this hobby that few people are and there's no commercial viability, but Jeff and Elon say passion's a secret to success. I'm super passionate about it. Therefore, I will make it big with my little rinky-dink hobby over here. This is what the masses believe, and yet outside of the context of something is already working and you know you have a small window of opportunity and you get excited about that naturally, passion propels you through that. Passion is something that is given to you by the opportunity, recognizing it for what it is, rather than, I'm super passionate about my hobby, I'm going to make a business out of it and become a millionaire.
So when Rick Rubin writes that you should, actually, I'll phrase it this way. When Rick Rubin writes a book of esoteric creative advice, it is framed in the context of the well-known albums and musicians he's produced. Whereas if an unknown author writes esoteric creative advice, the general public will react with, well, who are you to give this advice?
That's right. The social proof does the persuasion. So this more has to do with the context. Because Rick Rubin's brand, his personal brand, is one that whatever he says is going to work, because of his reputation, because of who he works with, then it's implied that it's trustworthy and you should read it too. So you can be like, it's social proof, right? Sort of, it's also known as a halo effect, in which the success of this person in other domains means that in this domain, their advice is going to work. Whereas beginners who have 100 followers on social media, maybe 2 articles published on their blog that a cumulative total of 50 people have visited in the last 5 years, follow the advice for a Rick Rubin or from a Rick Rubin for the Rick Rubin situation, and that's not going to pan out so great. But if Rick Rubin is giving that advice to one of the people he's working with, one of the recording artists, for example, that very well could be their breakthrough. But people are going to buy that individual's music and consume their content because the person taking Rick Rubin's advice is already a household name with 500,000 average per month Google searches for their name.
So how would someone create that context or halo effect? And especially, how would they create it if they want to create something that is a bit unique or strange or different in some way?
The most useful success advice that I have both received and been able to dispense is simply this: impress important people. Impress important people. What that means is you are capable and competent at your thing, whatever your thing is, but you decide to do that thing in the presence, the purview, or within proximity of someone who is esteemed, highly esteemed by a lot of people. One of the individuals who put me on the map, so to speak, is, of course, Scott Adams. Why? Because I impressed him and I work with him directly. I think we're on project number 3 or 4 at this point on stuff that we've done together and will be doing together. And the outcome of that is that I was capable and competent. He called me on the phone one day and he said, "Joshua, you know more about independent publishing than anyone in the world, right?" And I said, "Right, let's talk." And that was one of our projects we worked on together. But that was the result of demonstrated competence and capability in public that I'd done for years. He already knew who I was. I think our first conversation at that point had happened maybe 4 or 5 years prior to that. And so it's not just him, it's other people who have promoted my work, who've recommended me, who've bought from me, who have become clients of mine, that I being their ghostwriter. Why? Because I impressed them. I was doing my thing in public in such a way as to get noticed, doing it with excellence, but also doing it with an edge. Oftentimes being edgier, being willing to cross the line to court controversy to get noticed, assigns you the perception of courage, boldness, bravery. An incident which did that for me was what I like to call the Mary Sue affair, which occurred in December 2022, December 1st and 2nd, December 2022, when I was the news for a weekend. I had written a piece likening my experience ghostwriting memoirs, in which authors will tend to cast themselves as a one-dimensional, perfect hero or heroine character who never did anything wrong and they were always so successful and smart. But that's a terrible story. I was comparing that phenomenon to the Mary Sue of most popular film, entertainment, music, TV series, video games, etc., of the last 20 years or so, in which one-dimensional female characters who have seemingly no backstory and no struggle, they show up perfect at everything from the very beginning, and there's nothing to do with the character but make them act poorly, make them act like a villain almost. There's nothing else to do with the character. And I pointed out the new Galadriel from the anti-fan fiction piece known as Rings of Power, to Rey from Disney's Diversity Star Wars, so on and so forth. And I gave these examples of Mary Sue characters that did not resonate with audiences. And the response to that was overwhelmingly positive for the first day. And it was largely women, ironically, who were sharing it. Thank you. Someone finally said what I felt but couldn't quite find the words to say. And by the way, that's my tagline, the best way to say it. So when this is the job that I get done. See, I follow my own advice. I teach that I will help you find the best way to say it in your communications. And so here is an example of that. I'm demonstrating my competence in public, not just so in private. That post then went mega viral with the fandoms of Disney Star Wars and Lord of the Rings and elsewhere. They had a bad time with it. I was publicly shamed, harassed, and humiliated in the public square, and it was wonderful, and I profited off of it handsomely. And so rode that wave into infamy and success. And so the result of that was people saying, Joshua, you were willing to say something that you knew was going to make your reputation take a massive hit. It was going to get you published in all mainstream media as this terrible sexist, chauvinist, woman-hating, incel bigot, and yet you did it anyway. That takes guts. I want you to write for me. That was the outcome of that. That's another example. So it's a combination of competence and willingness to be controversial, not in a provocative or reactionary way, but to say what you think, but where it can be seen, where you can be heard. If you are writing controversial things and no one's reading it, particularly no one important who's championing it and say, you guys, you got to go see this. And then it gets 100,000 views. Well, then there's no point in that. So it's the combination of those things. It's being in front of people of influence and of means. It's the competence, which is the necessity. And I say in the beginning of my book, this is not for beginners. This is for intermediates to advanced who are already good at what they do. I'll just make you better and then best. So it's the eye of the VIPs. It's the competence. And it's also the not intentional controversy for controversy's sake, because then you just become an engagement farmer, a clickbait tycoon, but it's being willing to speak the truth as you see it, regardless of its unpopularity. And it seems like success for the up-and-comer exists in the intersection, or rather the zone where all three of those occur, that little triangle.
Let me ask, how do you determine who the people to impress are? Because if you wanted a job writing the next Star Wars book for Lucasfilm, that was probably not the way to go about it. So it seems like in that choice to do something bold and that would attract controversy, there was also a calculation about who you wanted to impress. And so I'm curious how you determine who that is.
Yes. So this is where a little bit of pragmatism comes, because to attract is to repel. To repel is to attract. And so it's not possible to resonate with some without ticking off others. So choose your enemies wisely. In fact, I believe that's the title of Patrick Bet-David's book.
How do you choose them, though?
He seems to be reading my material. Yes, he seems to be reading my material. It's textbook Lysik there. That said, when I think about who I want to work with, I also think about who I don't want to work with. I have worked directly with AWFLs, which is an acronym standing for Affluent White Female Liberals. I have ghostwritten for them. I have worked with them. I hated every second of it. And I have also worked with Christians, devout believers of Christianity, but of other faiths as well, traditional conservative-minded people, Republicans, and they have been above board, on the up and up, mutually respectful. They've been disciplined. They follow my instructions. They implement my advice. And progressive liberals and the woke have been the exact opposite of that. They have been angry, angsty, and they don't pay their bills. Therefore, I want to do what it takes to repel as many of them as possible from my sphere of influence. And in order to do that, I have to attract the others. To attract the others, I have to repel them. So it's a choice of who I want to associate myself with. Who do I want to be promoted by and to promote? And, oh, it would be so cool to write a next Star Wars novelization. Know the price of that success. That's another Scott Adamsism. Know the price of success and pay it. The price of that success is way too high for me, because I've been there. I've done that. I've known who it's like. Now, there are going to be other people who will say, I never want to work with religious people, ever. I only want to work with skeptics and atheists and agnostics and people of that nature. Then it would probably behoove them to create content excellent, with excellence, of course, that repels the one and attracts the other. It's the understanding of that polarity that exists within the market. And if you try to appease everyone, then you please no one. To appease everyone is to please no one. We must understand this if we are going to raise our profile and have ourselves become key persons of influence.
It sounds like the calculation of who you want to impress has a bit to do with who you enjoy working with. And what you actually want.
That's right. Yes. And who do I want to influence? I want to be a positive influence for Scott Adams. I want to be a positive influence for Christians and conservatives. I grew up in an evangelical Christian household. I don't hold many, if even any, of the beliefs that I held as a devout fundamentalist conservative Christian. But the civilization out of which those values and those morals come, I want to protect and safeguard because I'm married, I have children, I have a business. My level of prosperity that I have attained is built on top of a Western Christian civilizational foundation. And to lose that is to lose what I have. Therefore, to protect what I have, I must protect Christian civilization. And what are the best ways to protect Christian civilization? Well, it's to influence those people who can better protect it than I can. Therefore, I want to work with people who are going to make this civilization a better place, who are going to be able to institute more of rule of law and a creation of order rather than the strange sort of anarcho-tyranny that's going on in many U.S. cities and places and the long march of cultural communism, frankly, through the institutions in media, education, government, healthcare, and so on that we've seen. And I want to put a stop to it to the extent that I am able. Now, I'm not a lawyer, I'm not a judge, I'm not a politician, but I'm a professional persuader. Therefore, it behooves me to work with and to choose to work with people who have the opportunity to influence outcomes. And therefore, my place is to influence the influencers.
One of the things you've said is that bad reviews from bad people are good reviews. And I'm curious if there is such a thing as a bad review or how you would handle someone on your own side giving you a bad review. So the conservative movement, you said you want to influence them, but there's a lot of infighting in the conservative movement. And if some of that targeted you, I'm curious how you would handle it.
Yes, there's often an obvious intent behind criticism, critiques, public or private. Actual criticism. So I'll give an example of this. There was a legitimate mistake in a book that I was responsible for making. And someone on my team, so to speak, reached out to me and said, Joshua, would you mind some constructive criticism on something? This is in private. And I said, sure. And then he wrote me a novel-length piece of feedback on why he hated it, why it was terrible. It was no good, very bad, horrible, terrible, never do it again. What did I do? I fixed it. That is the appropriate way to offer good faith feedback, criticism, disagreement. Bad faith feedback, pseudo-criticism, is putting someone on blast in public to raise your profile, to grift on an issue so that you can profit then or soon after. Suppress someone, push someone down, therefore raising yourself up and attempting to take the moral high ground on the topic. I saw the cultural commentator James Lindsay attempt to do this to me over the weekend regarding the book. Instead of private feedback, there were a number of accusations levied against me about something that I had said, which I did not say. I corrected the record without incendiary language, without criticisms back. And then he immediately blocked me and began whining and complaining incessantly to his followers about my behavior and things that I had not said. I noticed TMZ did this to me following the Mary Sue affair. They took regarding from the Mary Sue piece criticizing the Mary Sue trope, they didn't republish the entire thing. They took out little quotes of it. And what they would do is they, and not just TMZ, but Yahoo, MSN, and other places that republished the story, they took half a sentence worth of an excerpt of, not a whole sentence, not a whole paragraph, a half a sentence, and they would say, Lysak said, and then the first half of a sentence, and then they would end it there, and then they would say, Lysak believes, and then they would say something I don't believe, and it wasn't evidence that I did. And then they would say, male chauvinist and anti-feminist bigots like Lysak, where do these labels come from? Out of nowhere. So they assigned me something I didn't believe, and then they would say I said something that I didn't. And they would often use adverbs. What Lysak is basically saying is women should never be depicted positively in media. They use the word basically. That's where I point out to people. I teach people to become immune to the manipulation of adverbs. When journalists or other commentators work in an adverb into a story that's indicative of them making something that didn't happen happen, or making something that did happen didn't happen. So they will say, the Trump administration essentially just something that did not essentially just happen. Or they'll say, President Biden is basically actually right now, literally pretty much something he's basically essentially actually not just pretty much doing at all. But this is what passes for journalism now. It's activism because people don't pay for news because the news is free. So what's the news apparatus supposed to do? Oh, the one sentence persuasion course says that to get people to do whatever you want them to do, you have to confirm their suspicions and validate their existing beliefs. People will pay for that. And therefore, the purpose of journalists is to tell people on their side that what they believe is in fact correct and all your suspicions were right all along. We see this both with Fox News and MSNBC, with NPR and with conservative talk radio. They serve the same function, and that is to tell people that what they already believe is in fact correct, and that's what the entire institutional apparatus is set up to do now in the name of news.
I have a direction I could go with that with Golly, you pack a lot into your answers, so I've got three different questions that I want to reply with. But let me go back to what you said earlier about the way that criticism is delivered. It sounds like that the distinction between good criticism and a bad review, so to speak, is the way in which it's delivered. A friendly criticism is delivered in a friendly way.
In private as well, in private. Yes, yes. I have deleted many a post and even publicly walked a few things back before because someone who cared about me and reputation said in private instantly. And it was not a question. It was, you should probably it's like, dude, terrible take. Dump it now.
Yeah.
You know, they're blasting me. They're putting me on the flame, so to speak, in private, which means I know they don't just care about me. They care about the cause, whatever the cause may be.
You also mentioned that a lot of news is set up just to confirm people's biases. And I'm wondering how you handle that in publishing, because I think a lot of the time people buy a book hoping on some level it'll just tell them what they already believe, especially opinion books. And if you have something you want to say to your audience that maybe isn't what they want to hear, how do you handle that as an author?
You have to tuck what they need to hear within the confines of what they want to hear. Something sometimes like 90-10, 80-20. 80% what they want to hear, 20% what they don't. 90% what they want to hear, 10% what they don't. An example of this I'm thinking of, because I can't not think of it, is in the health genre. What we've seen over the past 4 years, but much longer than that, it's first it was happening casually and gradually and then immediately all at once, was the departure from institutions as our truth generation apparatus. So it used to be that we would trust doctors and experts to tell us what the facts were. But the last few years have borne out that corruption, cash, and even intra-institutional tribalism, an adherence to a narrative at all costs, in order to achieve consensus, so they can have a single unified message. The CDC recommends X, unless you're a A, in which case they recommend Y, unless you're a B, in which case they say C. But if you're a C, don't do any of this, figure it out yourself. Institutions aren't going to say that. They have to give one rule that applies to everyone, which means, to borrow the criticism of product market fit, if it's for everyone, it's for no one. And that is exactly what institutions serve to do. They give the recommendation for everyone, and it turns out to be hardly for anyone. And we now realize that the official narrative about everything is false, if not misleading. But then there are the profiteers who notice this, and then will say the exact opposite of what the institutions say is the truth. Institutions say that Americans need more fiber and that red meat is probably not so great for your cardiovascular risk. Guess what? Plants kill you and red meat heals. And then an entire industry of low carb, ketogenic diet, carnivore influencers, authors, documentaries, so on and so forth, prop up to be the alternative to what the mainstream says. I've ghostwritten, can't remember if it's 16 or 17, we'll say 16, health, wellness, fitness, nutrition books in my career. And so I've seen, maybe not all angles, but many angles of this phenomenon where there's the official story and recommendation, and then there's the people who say, well, because the official sources are wrong about everything of importance, our pet theory, which is the opposite of it, is right. And then they create an us versus them narrative. They want you sick and fat and unhealthy and poor and eating the bugs, living in the pod and eating soy. They want you to be vegan and eat the bugs. So eat red meat instead. Be rebellious and have high testosterone. And it's politicized out of nowhere.
I'm going to take that little soundbite, by the way, and put it on the front of this episode and say, Joshua Lysak basically said this.
Yes, that would be journalism 101. Excellence.
But you go on, you're saying.
And yes, so that phenomenon we see in just about every topic. So if I'm hired by a carnivore influencer to produce a carnivore influence book, the job of that book is to tell people that what they want to hear. It's easy in the context of what news is for, what information is for. Remember, it's free. So people aren't going to pay for information. People aren't paying for recipes. They're paying to have their beliefs validated and their suspicions confirmed, which is, I'm quoting and also paraphrasing the One Sentence Persuasion course, which is a fantastic little resource. The most successful alternative to the mainstream diet influencer is the one who says, you know that junk food that you just love? Going back to when you were a kid, it was your craving, it was your favorite, it was the best. It turns out it's literally the most healthy thing you could ever put in your body. It's ancestral eating. It's eating according to our species. And all the vegans selling you kale and vegetarians that saying eggs are bad for you, they were wrong all along. Look, here's a picture of a skinny, pale-faced, balding vegan. Do you want to look like that? Or do you want to look like the 70-year-old carnivore with brilliantly shaped muscles? And he's got an 8-pack, a girlfriend, and a hot car. He eats meat 4 times a day. Which one do you want to look like? You want to be a soy boy? You weesh dude? It's nakedly obvious what they, or maybe I, am doing with that messaging. But it works. It works. Now, it turns out that there are decentralized networks of people who suffer the consequences of the carnivore diet, but those people are ostracized from the community. Their comments, replies, questions are deleted or they go not responded to. And there's even been a case of carnivore, low-carbon, ketogenic influencers disappearing suddenly from their accounts, going back over the last 10 years. Originally, it was with the paleo phenomenon, you know, circa 29, 2010, and just disappearing, no longer posting. And then it coming out that such and such carnivore bodybuilder, paleo influencer passed away at age 54 from a cardiovascular event. Oh. Huh. Well, hashtag meat heals I eat raw eggs at every meal because it's literally primal eating. It's ancestral dieting. All of this is all, it's all marketing. There is no such thing as ancestral dieting or anything of the nature because humans are flexitarians. We eat what's available to us that has the highest amount of nutritional density. And people will say, well, what about bioavailability? Well, consider the best evidence we have right now. And this is where I like to say that that reality is somewhere between the extremes, but it's nuanced, and therefore it does not appeal to tribes. It's not profitable. I can't write a book on the facts of the matter of health, wellness, fitness, and nutrition, on just the facts, because nobody wants to buy that book. People want to buy information that tells them they're right all along. You know that cheese, that a greasy cheese pizza and that greasy triple bacon cheeseburger with the 5 slices of cheese? That's actually health food. Just lose the bun. And I'm not even kidding. These threads go viral and get like millions of views and impressions and shares and make people ultra successful fitness influencers until suddenly they disappear from their account and when no one knows what happened to them. And that has been a phenomenon.
But why can't you write that book? I mean, isn't the issue with writing that book just the halo and marketing needed? So for example, if, I don't know, a really famous athlete wrote that book and said, look, to perform at my level, you need to actually have the balanced diet that isn't some sort of meme diet. Wouldn't he be able to write that book because of the status that that person has?
The most successful in terms of financial fitness health space influencers are pill pushers. And by this, I mean supplement salespeople. They have their own brand of desiccated liver pills or bison liver jerky.
I'm remembering when the story came out that both Alex Jones and Gwyneth Paltrow were selling the same supplement, just branded differently. So they were buying it from the same supplier, and then they'd each put a different label on it. And I think one of them was, you know, branded as very alpha male and the other was very new agey, but it's the same supplement underneath. So I'm familiar with that business model.
Yes. And for fitness influencers, it's difficult to make a fantastic living unless you are working within a tribe. Because tribalism is profitable. Nuance is a no man's land because there's no one to rally around you. So the influencer who comes out and says, look, the best archaeological evidence we've been able to arrive at to date is that the quote-unquote ancestral diet of the earliest Homo sapiens was a combination of tubers, like root vegetables, potatoes, yams, etc., and bone marrow, because those were two food sources that other animals had not been able to reach. So you had other animals, predators, for example, the four-legged ones who would devour the animal, and unless the hyenas were around to crunch on the bones, some of the bones would be left behind. And then humans with primitive stone tools would be able to dig out the bone marrow. So there's your bone broth, right? Okay, there's something. But then the people who are bone broth salespeople tend to not be sweet potato chip salespeople. You don't typically see that. There's a whole ethos and pathos around this is the right way to do it. Feel like you're nourishing your body and getting your testosterone and eating these animal-based foods. And the system doesn't want you eating animals. The system wants you to be a pale, skinny, high blood pressure, low testosterone, vegan soy male, right? This is the messaging. And so you feel good about paying 50% upmark or upcharge on desiccated liver pills, for example, from such and such grifter supplement brand, when you can get the same thing from your local health alternative food store.
But couldn't you write the truth if you just had a different business model? I mean, it seems to me like what you're setting up is that the business model is the obstacle to just writing the truth.
I expect it is. Also, it has to do with desirability. Remember, we know that persuasion is telling people that what they've already believed and what they've thought and what they felt is already true. They're easily persuaded to do that. The average person does not know how to cook yams or sweet potatoes. The average person does not have much skill in the kitchen whatsoever. But anyone can throw a steak on the grill or put bacon in the pan, for example. But like making broccoli taste great, or kale, or other leafy green vegetables that are high in vitamins and minerals, those are difficult to prepare with consistency. And so it's easier to tell those people, like Paul Saladino does, kale is bullshit, is his slogan. Oh, wow. I knew it. I always knew that it tasted bad. It was bad for you. And now I have evidence from a guy with a six pack who looks great. He's fit. He's sexy. Obviously, I can trust him. Halo effect, remember? Oh, and he says that the human body is only ever made to eat animal foods. Well, great. I love steak and eggs and cheeseburgers and hamburgers, hot dogs and bacon and butter. That's the pinnacle of health food and success. It's easy to get people into that. Whereas practical skills like making a nutritionally dense, low sugar sweet potato casserole that's high protein, the typical person, average person, does not know how to do that. But they do know how to throw bacon on the grill. Therefore, which is easier to sell information about?
Wouldn't there be a case to be made here, though, that impressing the right people would be writing the book that has the difficult advice? In other words, the kind of person that is going to put that amount of effort into their health and their cooking is maybe a better audience to sell to than the kind of person who thinks that putting a sweet potato in the oven and leaving it in there for 45 minutes is too complex.
The way you describe that is rather pitiful, and yet that is the status quo of the situation. The issue with the skill level, there's like Zoomers like to say, skill issue, bruh. This is a skill issue, bruh. The issue is that buy my desiccated liver pills for $18 for a week's supply or whatever it is. I don't know. Don't remember. Versus here's a recipe to prepare a multi-ingredient, let's say, non-animal foods based meal. The cognitive load being borne by both of those is so different that it is known that the more you ask a customer to do, the less likely they are to do it. Beat the system. Be a man. Buy my liver pills. Easy to understand.
Joshua, it sounds...
Go ahead.
It sounds like the author of Unhumans is telling me right now that capitalism is the problem.
I would say what we're describing is the consumer psychology that is being mass manipulated for profit-seeking ends at all costs.
That sounds like capitalism.
Now, Karl Marx had several critiques of capitalism, the industrial capitalism in particular, which were correct. I gave an interview right before this. We were talking about the book I'm working on with Jack Posobiec. And
you're giving me a really nuanced answer for a guy who says that nuanced answers don't sell. If you're telling me that maybe Karl Marx was right about certain things.
Yes. So what I am delivering as a call to action is not directly tied to the subject in terms of a value ladder. Value ladders are how you make the big bucks in any business. So it's like, buy my $17 course about how to prepare your own butter and make butter-rich animal foods for breakfast, lunch, and dinner. And then buy my $99 course about breakfast, lunch, and dinner. And then get in my community for $500 a year. And then get my private coaching for $1,000 a month. And like the whole value ladder is built out of it, right? I have a value ladder here. I have value sticks. The scalability of nuance is not existent. So what we have is a skill issue. So if I'll get back to the question of Marx in a moment. Don't worry. But this question of could an influencer have a nuanced take that has the realization that humans are flexitarians and we can survive and thrive, yes, as carnivores, yes, as vegans, 100% both of them, and also there are some considerations that people ought to take in terms of what's available to them, what their body uniquely needs. And then you reach the place where you can't say everyone needs to eat only animal-based foods. That becomes no longer practical. Or that every single person needs to eat more fiber and therefore should be vegetarian and have non-starchy vegetables 5 times a day. That may not be exactly the case, particularly for sufferers of irritable bowel syndrome. So then you have a situation where only one-on-one advice works, but that's not scalable. Teaching skills like cooking, perhaps AI will enable to be made scalable. But right now, the best way to learn cooking skills is through a hands-on small group class of like you and 5 other people going to the same kitchen cooking school, like for once a week for 90 days or something like that, and spending a few hundred or even a few $1,000s. And those places exist, but the price of admission is a bit high for most. So it's a fundamentally non-scalable, it's not a value ladder. It's like a value stool. And therefore, it's not a great way to make a whole lot of money, but particularly if you're looking to maximize a value you extract from the marketplace. Coming back to Karl Marx, one of my earliest viral videos I had, this is like 4 years ago maybe, is I it's still available on Twitter X, by the way. I believe it, the title of it is Marx Was Right About This. So I took a class in university that was about Marxism, and it was taught by one of the only conservative professors in the entire university. So it was a perfect teacher topic fit that we had right there. And he pointed out that prior to the solutions of communist revolution that Marx recommended, he identified one of the problems, and he termed it alienation. That industrial capitalism created the alienation of families from one another, the husband and wife from each other, the parents from the children from their siblings, and the parents from the fruit of their own labor, until the man was alienated from himself and became a shell. He became a hollowed nothing. Now, he was correct, because the Industrial Revolution, particularly in Europe, it took the small family business, whether it was a subsistence farmer or a tradesman or craftsperson, where the husband worked near home, the wife worked near home or in the home, the kids helped, daughters helped mom, kids helped dad, or they helped the uncle or the cousin, or there was these families and extended family units that made up the fabric of society, be it villages, towns, or even in cities. But what rapid industrialization brought was parents now go work in factories. Kids either be sent to a school to be made into factory workers through compliance and other things that they would be taught, not practical skills, but learn how to sit down, shut up, and obey. And then sometimes kids would be even put in factories. And so mom and dad wouldn't see each other anymore during the day. Kids wouldn't see each other anymore during the day. The siblings would be separated and be age segregated according to their class so that they could be properly brainwashed with other people in their age group. And in the past, when the man would feel pride for making this chair, let's say with his 14-year-old son, starting with the wood and fashioning it into a chair that could last for 300 years and then some, seeing and feeling and selling the fruit of his labor, he was now standing on an assembly line, moving a widget from point A to point B. And he was alienated from the reward of the labor itself. So this conservative professor of mine pointed out that Marx was correct about the alienation that had occurred. His solution was burn it all down. rob and kill everyone who owns all this stuff. So when communism has been implemented, whether it was called communism or progressivism or leftism or the Jacobins in revolutionary France or the Khmer Rouge in Cambodia, regardless of what they've called themselves, communists tend to find, radical leftists, revolutionaries, they do find a people who have a legitimate grievance many times. They find a people with a legitimate grievance. And then they gather them, they manipulate them into a new ethic, a new morality, which says, we need more than equality, we need equity, which means revenge. They did this to you, now you must make it fair. You need to get retribution. Look how much they've taken from you. It's your turn to take everything from them. It's only fair. So they use the language of fairness, equity, this sorts of language when they're riling up the mob, and then they will unleash them. And what we go from is, you don't have equality. Things are rough for this class or this group of people. The revolution comes, and then it's now worse for everyone. A rather tragic, dark, comedic, but tragic nonetheless, experience of this is in communist Haiti. What? Haiti had a communist revolution? You bet they did. The Haitian Revolution at the turn of the century, following the French Revolution and kind of coinciding with that, there was, of course, the slave revolts. And the communists of Haiti, proto-communists we might call them, were heralded as being great liberators and a successful slave rebellion, freeing the slaves, right? Well, this is where the secret history that Jack and I teach that adds some interesting little factoids and some nuance. And by the way, we're not building a value ladder. There's not like the Unhumans Masterclass and then the Inner Circle for $75,000 a year. Like, we're not building a value ladder out of this to maximally grift. This is really a one and done personal project sort of a matter. Although a value ladder would be kind of funny, but also it'd feel a little gross out of this.
Well,
but returning to revolutionary Haiti, prior to the revolution and the slave revolts, the French colonists, they granted first biracial Haitians and then fully black Haitians, they granted them civil rights, and then they eliminated slavery, which were the real grievances, the legitimate grievances. But there was a revolt anyway. And when the former slaves at this point revolted and took charge, they instituted a white genocide. Every white person or biracial person on the island was stripped of their citizenship, their rights, their property. And they and their children were all executed if they couldn't escape off the island. And then what did they do? The Haitian revolutionaries reinstituted slavery. They ordered all the peasants back onto the farms where they had been slaves years prior. And then that person was overthrown by the next person, who then undid slavery. But then he reinstituted slavery. And then we see the state that Haiti is in today. And we can unfortunately trace its situation back to this promise of heaven, if only got rid of our oppressors. And then what they gave them was a perpetual hell for over 200 years now. And that's what communists do every single time they take power. But there are nuanced takes about Marx and his political theories that I think are worth knowing and worth considering. But what is not nuanced is that his solution to the problem he identified is not a solution. It's more of an anti-solution. Rob, loot, and kill everything, and then everything.
You know what
better.
I'm noticing is that the same problem that you're describing in marketing a book is present in what you're talking about around communist revolutions, in that you as an author or as a political leader have identified a real problem. But what is successful in the market is sometimes a highly mimetic, simple statement, as opposed to the nuanced truth. So just eat only meat is a very simple mimetic statement that maybe will lead to some cardiovascular issues. And just kill the oppressor is also a very simple mimetic statement that maybe will lead to even more oppression than before. So it sounds like you're dealing with the same problem.
Yes, and it's even more deceitful than that. I believe it was Michaela Peterson who popularized hashtag meat heals. And there have been a number of paleo, keto, and other fitness influencers now in the carnivore space who'd like to use the phrases ancestral foods, ancestral eating, primal eating, these sorts of positive sounding phrases that, but you're against ancestral eating? You know better than our ancestors? These are primal foods. These are bioavailable nutrient-dense foods, they'll say. What do you got against bioavailability? Don't you want to take care of yourself? So resistance to the message is an accusation. It's evidence of your guilt. This is what Vladimir Lenin did, ironically, in communist Russia, in order to rally the peasants to his side. So the Bolsheviks were a radical group of political activists who wanted to overthrow the government, which they eventually did. And the way they rounded up enough popular support to form these mass mobs and then give them guns and then unleash them on their alleged oppressors. And let's be real, the Tsarist Russia was a terrible place for peasants, for the working class and the underclass. And serfs were effectively slaves until 1861. Interesting year for the end of slavery in Russia. But Vladimir Lenin's slogan was peace, land, bread. So I will end Russia's involvement in World War I. I will end the indentured servitude and de facto debt slavery that the land ownership system at that time created. And then bread, well, make sure everybody has enough to eat so we'll no longer have starvation. And of course, that was the promise. Oh, so you're against peace? You're against land? You're against bread? Now, we notice that cultural Marxists use similar language that to oppose is to make you a bad person. Three examples top of mind. Love is love. Black Lives Matter. Another one being reproductive rights. What, you're trying to infringe on my rights? You don't like black people? You're a racist? You bigot? What do you want? What do you want this to be, 1860 antebellum world? You want to own slaves again? What's wrong with you? Or what have you got against love? You've got hate. Hate has no home here. It's another one. Science is real. These sorts of things, right? Believe the science. These simple 2 to 3 word expressions that to oppose them is to make yourself a bad guy. It's to be an oppressor. And this is what revolutionaries do. But they're effectively marketing the revolution. And marketing is marketing regardless of where it's being applied. Whether it's for communism or if it's for carnivorism.
What's interesting to me about that, though, is that you're seeing the same problem in two very different contexts. So it's the problem of a thought-terminating cliché.
Yes.
And meat heals is a thought-terminating cliché. And what was Lenin's slogan again? Peace and bread?
Peace, land, bread.
Peace, land, bread is also a thought-terminating cliché. I mean, it's sort of a political slogan, but it's something where if you start thinking about it in a nuanced way, the statement starts to fall apart. And so I'm curious how, because it seems to me people who read books are looking to think about something in depth. And one thing I wanted to ask you about at some point is why you think that the so few people are reading, why that is sort of dropping off. But it seems to me that books are the place to have a nuanced discussion. So how would you solve that problem? Since it seems like both contexts where you're dealing with something difficult have this challenge of overcoming simple falsehoods with something more nuanced.
Yes. We'll now close the loop I opened at the beginning talking about jobs to be done. The job a reader is trying to get done differs based on which tool they're purchasing, or in this case, which type of book, which genre of book. Often when people buy a book on a topic, the job they're looking to get done is to introduce themselves and familiarize themselves with a topic to see if there's more for them there. This, by the way, is why I work with so many entrepreneurs, founders, and executives who write a book about their subject matter, that is their business, their service that they offer, so that future clients can familiarize themselves with the terminology, the processes, and the offerings that they sell so that it's easier to upsell and cross-sell those readers who've now familiarized themselves and have self-persuaded themselves through their research and they want to do business with them. So that's how books can become profitable funnels. I'm not opposed to capitalism. Not opposed to capitalism. That said, returning back to what other subject matters, be they for book funnels or for, let's say, entertainment purposes or just information seeking, what a book needs to do is it needs to persuade the person that this is the correct way. This is the right way. it needs to pull a one sentence persuasion course. It needs to, like that one sentence persuasion course says, it needs to confirm their suspicions. It needs to throw rocks at their enemies, is another phrase. It needs to give them hope, alleviate their fears. It needs to win them over that this is the way you've been looking for your entire life and you know it. And often a nuanced position which weighs both sides of a matter is done with logos, not with pathos. That's logic versus persuasion. And we know that in consumer psychology, consumers, including readers of books, make their decisions emotionally and then justify logically. Therefore, given that understanding, books that have a nuanced position tend not to sell well. They tend to get relegated. They tend not to pick up word of mouth because there's not a tribe that's championing it. Nielsen found a number of years ago that 92% of book sales are attributable to word of mouth marketing. The best way to word of mouth market a book is to get it into a tribe of people, be it carnivores or be it vegans. And there are no vegans who are going to recommend a nuanced book that talks about the benefits of animal products. And vice versa, carnivores recommending vegan books. That's just not going to happen. And therefore, they're much less likely to enjoy the commercial success that comes from word of mouth marketing into it. And so can we blame capitalism? I don't think we can blame capitalism of anything we're not blaming humans themselves for. we have made a system that's in our image.
Got it. So it sounds like if you have something nuanced you want to put out into the world, that you have to find people, I'll use another Greek word, thumos, who are going to have a lot of spirited energy for that nuanced thing, the same way they would for something that was simple. And are going to share it that way and promote it that way and are going to make it a part of their identity the way that someone would, you know, make a very, let's say, more polarizing take part of their identity. Is that fair to say or accurate?
Yes. The closer a given piece of information is to someone's identity, the more strongly they're going to hold to it. So for example, someone who's made their living as a carnivore influencer or a low carb person is not going to out one day talk about the benefits of whole plant food based diet. That's not going to happen. Or they're not going to talk about how essential fiber is, like the fact that so many digestive diseases and issues are traced back to lack of fiber in the diet. That's just not going to happen, even though people might need that.
Wouldn't a former carnivore guy suddenly becoming vegan be an attention-getting thing to do that would be embraced by a different tribe?
It certainly could be, and that's why you see a lot of self-proclaimed ex-vegans become carnivore influencers. So the character P.D. Mangan, his shtick is he's an ex-vegan, former vegan. That's his thing. To create that social proof. Look, I came from the other side. I have the nuance. So it's a sort of a pathos by means of logos. It's, look, I'm the logical one. I've weighed both sides, which appeals to emotional. It's an emotional persuasive appeal. I can do one more question, Brendan.
Oh, you only have time for one more. Are you sure you only have time for one more? I will. We might have to do a part two if you've.
Yeah, my kids are literally banging my door.
All right. Well, I'll give you the question I always ask at the end of these. Is there anything that I didn't ask that you really want to get to that you didn't get to say?
I think a topic that we both care about is the circumcision debate intact, right? So we don't, as parents, my wife and I, we don't believe in that. We don't prescribe to that. And we found that that's an issue that is difficult to persuade people to adopt if they've already made a different choice for their son or their sons and it's too late to do anything about. that is an interesting persuasion case study, that if it's too late for someone to do anything about it, they will are probably not going to change their minds about it. In fact, they will dig in even more heavily and say that they were right all along and you're wrong and you're a bad person. Yeah. This is what I've noticed. It's another little mini persuasion case study talking about circumcision in public.
Oh, there's many things I could get into about persuasion there. We might have to, there is a solution I may have to that second piece, but we'll save it if we ever get to do a part two.
Sure thing.
Well, Joshua, thank you so much for coming on. This has been super interesting. I might have to invite you on again because there's so much more we could talk about, but thank you again for doing this one.
My pleasure, Brendan. I was glad to.
Thank you for listening to The Brendan Morata Show. If you liked this episode, please leave a positive review on whatever platform you listen to podcasts on. If you really liked this episode, please support the show and become a paying subscriber, giving you access to special bonus material only available to supporters of the show. I want to thank you for listening to this show, and I will talk to you all later.